In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. He had three ships and left from Spain. He sailed through sunshine, wind, and rain.
Not the most sublime poetry, but millions of Americans have been brought up on this rhyme. Many of them regard the Italian-born Christopher Columbus as the discoverer of America, and his voyage is celebrated as one of the country's national holidays. Yet in a lot of ways, Columbus Day is a bit of a con trick. For a start, Columbus wasn't the first to discover the Americas. Viking sailors visited Newfoundland 1,000 years ago, giving it the name Vinland and describing it fondly in their sagas.
They found wild wheat growing in fields on all the low ground and grapevines on all the higher ground. Every stream was teeming with fish. They dug trenches at the high tide mark, and when the tide went out, there were halibut trapped in the trenches. In the woods, there was a great number of animals of all kinds, but they realized that although the land was excellent, they could never live there in safety or freedom from fear because of the native inhabitants.
The natives had been on the North American continent for thousands of years, and the Vikings were the first European visitors, so Columbus was a relative latecomer. What's more, he never set foot in what is now the United States. All his four voyages were to the Caribbean islands or Central America. And some Native Americans have a deeper reason for objecting to Columbus Day. As we'll see in a moment, they regard Columbus not as a hero, but as a killer. So how come Columbus Day is celebrated across the United States every October? It was President Franklin Roosevelt who made it official, and he did so to please Italian Americans who were big backers of his Democratic Party in the 1930s. Roosevelt held up Columbus as the embodiment of all American values, calling him
a great Italian whose vision and leadership and courage pointed the way to this new world of ours. Once launched upon this great voyage, he did not turn back. There were those who offered him the counsel of despair. There were those who thought that the price they were paying was too great. But the valiant admiral, firm to his purpose, sailed on.
It was in the spirit of Columbus, Roosevelt claimed, that intrepid pioneers went on to tame the American West.
You are scarcely removed one generation from men and women who, cast in the same mould, sought to conquer nature for the benefit of the nation.
Conquering nature for the benefit of the nation. Roosevelt encapsulated the belief of many Americans that their continent was originally virgin land, ripe for exploitation by settlers from Europe. This was certainly Columbus's view. Coming ashore in the Caribbean in 1492, he considered the Americas a paradise and its natives a pushover. In fact, thinking he'd reached the Indies, he called the natives Indians, and that label has stuck. Columbus told his patrons, the King and Queen of Spain,
"These lands are so good and fertile that there is no one who could believe it if he had not seen them. And this island and all the others are as much yours as Castile. There is only wanting a settlement and the order to the people to do what is required. For I, with the force I have under me, which is not large, could march over all these islands without opposition. I have seen only three sailors land, without wishing to do harm, and a multitude of Indians fled before them. They have no arms, and are without warlike instincts. They all go naked, and are so timid that 1,000 would not stand before 3 of our men. So they are good to be ordered about, to work and sow, and to do all that may be necessary, and to build towns, and they should be taught to go about clothed, and to adopt our customs."
Here already was a basic mission statement. Establish a colony, civilize the natives, and put them to work. Indian agriculture, structured around the basic crops of maize, squash, and beans, didn't impress Europeans accustomed to logging the forests, putting land to the plough, milling grain to make bread, and using domesticated animals for meat and milk. To them, that was real farming. The natives seemed to be engaged in gardening. Well, today we may feel a little less snobbish. The Indians knew that maize, squash, and beans thrived best when raised together, hence the nickname Three Sisters. even though they didn't understand the underlying chemistry of how nitrogen and phosphorus were shared through the root systems. The settlers, by contrast, exploited the land ruthlessly, cutting down the trees and exhausting the soil through intensive cultivation, before moving on to pastures new. As we'll see, that became a refrain of American history, what Roosevelt later called conquering nature for the benefit of the nation. Of course, we shouldn't romanticize the Native Americans as a kind of early greens, in contrast with the ecological vandals from Europe. But many of the settled tribes did have a keen sense of dependence on nature. This was expressed in folk stories still told today.
The earth is alive. We spend our entire lives defiling the earth, pissing on her, and that is why she gets annoyed. All things of value come out of the earth. And yet, here we are disturbing the earth, occupying it, and planting on it all through our lives. We get drunk on it, but we don't give the earth any beer. We don't give her what she wants. And that is the reason that she forsakes us and doesn't want to produce. Corn is extremely delicate. Corn is our blood. How can we grab our living from the earth when it is our own blood that we are eating?
Corn or maize was one of the plants that Columbus brought back from the New World, together with kidney beans and the sweet potato. Later came pineapple, tobacco and the turkey, pumpkin, the strawberry and the tomato, to name but a few of the early exports from the New World to the Old. Many of these seemed pretty dubious at first. William Salmon, an 18th century English quack, asserted that potatoes,
being boiled, baked or roasted, increase seed and provoke lust, causing fruitfulness in both sexes, and stop all sorts of fluxes of the belly.
Yet potatoes became a basic food for the Irish peasantry during the 17th century, and then caught on throughout Europe. Maize was grown mostly in warmer climes, such as Spain, Italy and the Balkans, but turkeys spread rapidly across Europe, at least on rich men's tables. William Strickland, a Yorkshire gentleman who went on voyages of exploration in his youth, is generally credited with their introduction to England. His coat of arms in 1550, showing a turkey cock in his pride proper, is one of the earliest European drawings of the bird. From the New World, in fact, came some of the staples of modern Europe, foods that were often much more productive than traditional crops. Potatoes have about a 50% higher calorific yield per acre than wheat, oats or barley. Better nutrition meant stronger, healthier people who were more resistant to disease. Over a couple of centuries, these new foods played an important part in the dramatic growth in Europe's population. Not all the imports were beneficial. Tobacco has probably accounted for millions of premature deaths over the centuries. Also on the debit side, it's possible that Columbus and his sailors brought back venereal disease from the New World, though this remains controversial. In any case, syphilis hardly compares with the diseases the Europeans took west across the Atlantic. These had much graver consequences. That story begins in 1493, with Columbus's second voyage to establish a proper colony on the island of Hispaniola near Cuba. An infection, probably influenza, spread throughout the crew. Many Spanish died from the disease, but it completely devastated the local Taino Indians. With fewer hands to cultivate their crops, food supplies contracted and famine took hold. The Taino, 300,000 strong in 1492, were virtually extinct 50 years later. The story of Hispaniola, though extreme, wasn't unusual. Later waves of settlers brought new and even deadlier diseases, especially smallpox and measles. These could still be killers in Europe, but most of the emigrants had developed some form of immunity, whereas the Indians had none. One epidemic after another allowed them little chance to reproduce and recover. It was in fact disease, as much as firearms and steel swords, which helps explain the astonishingly rapid collapse of the great Inca Empire in what is now Peru. Spanish expeditions also spread European disease up the Mississippi, and the English had a similar impact along the Atlantic seaboard. In 1620, the Pilgrims who'd arrived on the Mayflower built their settlement, Plymouth, on the site of an Indian village that had been ravaged by smallpox and measles. The Pilgrims' historian, William Bradford, vividly described the effects on the Indians of another smallpox epidemic.
For want of bedding and linen and other helps, they fall into a lamentable condition as they lay on their hard mats. The pox breaking and mattering and running one into another, their skin cleaving by reason thereof to the mats they lie on. When they turn themselves, a whole side will flay off at once, and they will be all of a gore blood, most fearful to behold. And then, being very sore, what with cold and other distempers, they die like rotten sheep.
Although very few of the local Indians escaped, Bradford records,
"By the marvellous goodness and providence of God, not one of the English was so much sick."
Bradford says the settlers had compassion for the Indians, fetching them food and water, but the devastating effect of the pox was by no means unwelcome. Migrants from England crossed the Atlantic with a well-developed concept of private property, claiming the right to take land that wasn't occupied or used productively. So the decimation of the Indians opened the way for European settlement, physically, legally, and even theologically. John Winthrop, the first governor of the Puritan colony of Massachusetts, wrote home in 1634.
"As for the natives, they are near all dead of the smallpox. So, as the Lord hath cleared our title, to what we possess."
So how many American Indians actually died from European-born disease? That's a matter of fierce debate among historians. Without any hard evidence, the figures proposed are informed guesses, and they diverge wildly. But a mid-range estimate suggests that the Indian population of North America fell from 5 million in 1492 to only 500,000 by 1650. In other words, the continent wasn't virgin land ripe for the taking. Widowed land seems a more accurate description. So it's easy to understand why many Native Americans today aren't too keen on Columbus. His forename, Christopher, means literally bearer of Christ. But for millions of American Indians, Columbus was the bearer of death.